I'm going to talk about a number of points. One of the things I think we ought to be interested in is the impact of the web on our sensibility, on our modes of cognition. To put it very bluntly, what effect does looking at a computer screen or one of these telephone screens all day long have on my students? And I think to answer that question, you'd have to do more empirical research than has been done. So I will give you some impressionistic answers based on my own experiences. I think that, to put it crudely, the attention span of my students is lower today than it was 20 or 30 years ago. A sustained concentration of the sort that is necessary to master, let's say, Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, or even Hegel's Logik um Gottes Willen, I think they find that very hard. It was never easy, but I think if you spend all day looking at a screen and you find you can get instant gratification simply by clicking, moving some sort of electronic switch, then the kind of sustained concentration that I sometimes try to require is much less possible than it used to be. Now, another effect, more beneficial effect, of the web has been an increase in the sense of, I don't know how else to describe it, the sense of power. There's a kind of empowerment. A conventional criticism of democratic theories was always that freedom of the press didn't mean anything if you didn't own a newspaper. Well, now, in a sense, everybody owns a newspaper. You can have a blog and you can reach large numbers of people. I don't know how many friends my students have on Facebook. I've never been on Facebook, and the idea that you might have 500 or 5,000 friends seems slightly preposterous to me, but they do reach fairly large audiences. And I do think that is, that does give a sense of empowerment. Now, it has one disadvantage, and that is, to put it very crudely, it encourages a kind of dishonesty in self-presentation. Whenever I read the self-descriptions of people I know well on Facebook, they don't tell flat lies, but they certainly color the story to present themselves in a very favorable light. The idea that self-presentation might be done with a certain level of dishonesty is nothing new, but there is a greater satisfaction if you know that large numbers of people are going to view it, and it's available generally to the general public on the web. So I'd like to see some more research on the effects of internet technology on our sensibility, and I assume that somebody's going to be doing this. I'm not the person to do it. But what I'm going to talk about today is mostly having to do with my distress at certain widespread impressions that people have of internet technology that seem to me massively confused. I was aware of this when it was widely advertised and generally accepted that in exactly the same sense in which Kasparov beat Karpov in chess, so in that sense Deep Blue beat Kasparov. You all know about this. IBM spent a lot of money inventing a program. By now, the technology is not working. I think there's something ought to worry us about that, because, of course, in order for you or me to play chess, we have to be aware of the fact that we're playing chess, and that we open the pawn to king 4, and our queen is threatened. All that kind of thing. But of course, Deep Blue, how about that? Is that better? Deep Blue is not aware of any of that because it's not aware of anything. It's not designed to be. It's a piece of, it's an electronic circuit, and it has no consciousness whatever. And the same thing came out with something called Jeopardy, when a program was designed that could beat anybody in the world at Jeopardy. I've never played nor seen Jeopardy, but I guess it's some kind of a television quiz show. And the computer was supposed to be better than anyone else in the world. Now, in a way, it seems sort of ill-tempered to say, well, it doesn't really play chess and it doesn't really play Jeopardy, because that's what it was designed to do. It was designed to play at chess and win at chess. So what's going on? Well, then I felt I had to say something about this when I was given two books for review both by professors in my old university, Oxford, one an Italian, Floridi, and another one, a Swede named Bostrom, and I was hoping Floridi would be here, but I gather he can't make it. But in any case, these books advanced theses, which I thought were, to put it crudely, mistaken. And I'm going to now try to expose the mistakes because I think they're widespread. Floridi holds the view that we live in a sea of information. To put it in a Hegelian style, everything is information. As he puts it, paraphrasing or parodying Hegel, the real is informational and the informational is real. And he celebrates this. He thinks that's the most wonderful thing that could happen. And we are all, he cheerfully tells us, inforgs. You are an inforg. I am an inforg. We're all inforgs. And Bostrom is less optimistic about internet technology. His thesis is the following. We've already got smart computers, and pretty soon we're going to have very smart computers, and they're going to be much smarter than we are. Now, when they get to be a lot smarter than we are, and that will come sooner than you think, there's a real danger that they might simply rise up and overthrow us. How can we suppose that, given that they're so much smarter than we are, that they will continue to regard us with anything other than a kind of genial contempt in such a way that they might simply want to get rid of us as being unnecessary nuisances in a world of their superior intelligence? Okay, I think both of these views are massively confused, but in order to explain that, I have to give you some tools for thinking about this. So here goes with some rather boring distinctions that people don't generally make. First of all, there's an ambiguity in our notion of objectivity and subjectivity. These notions loom large in our intellectual culture, but they're systematically ambiguous between an epistemic sense, where epistemic means having to do with knowledge, and an ontological sense, where ontological means having to do with existence. In the epistemic sense, the distinction between objectivity and subjectivity is the distinction between two types of claims or statements or hypotheses. Some claims can be settled, as they say, as matters of objective fact. If I say Rembrandt was born in 1606, that is epistemically objective. If I say Rembrandt is the greatest Dutch painter that ever lived, well, that's, as they say, a matter of subjective opinion. That's epistemically subjective. Now, I want everybody to get that, because underlying that distinction is a distinction in modes of existence. Some things have an existence that depend on being experienced by a conscious subject. Pains and tickles and itches all are ontologically subjective because they only exist insofar as they're experienced by a human or animal subject. But of course, most of the things that interest the natural sciences have an ontologically objective existence. Mountains, molecules, and tectonic plates exist regardless of what anybody thinks. They don't depend on being experienced in order to exist. Now, okay, everybody's got that. There's a distinction. I was going to write it on the blackboard, but we don't. How much time do I have, by the way? Half an
40
hour?
40 minutes.
What?
40 minutes.
Okay, 40 minutes. I can say it all in 40 minutes. Okay. Now, I want you to get that, though. There are two different senses of the objective-subjective distinction, an epistemic and an ontological. And the epistemic distinction is entirely about claims. The ontological distinction is about modes of existence. Now, part of the importance of this is that lots of things that have a subjective mode of existence, ontologically subjective, admit of study, which is epistemically objective. When I first got interested in consciousness, I went over to UCSF, where they have a big brain research center, and basically what I told them was, get busy and solve the problem of consciousness. What the hell am I paying you guys to do? It's to figure out how the brain does it. And a standard answer I got was, that's not a scientific question. Consciousness is best left to philosophers and theologians. I love being lumped together with the theologians, but anyway. Why? Well, on your own account, consciousness is subjective, but science is objective. Therefore, there cannot be a science of consciousness. you all recognize the fallacy of ambiguity. Science is indeed epistemically objective, but the epistemic objectivity does not prevent us from getting a scientific account of an ontologically subjective domain. I finally think I got that across to most of the people who are patient enough to listen to me try to explain it. Okay, now there's another distinction which is going to be crucial for our discussion, and that's a distinction between those features of reality that exist regardless of what anybody thinks, that are, so to speak, observer independent, and those that depend for their very existence on there being certain attitudes taken toward the phenomena in question. So again, mountains, molecules, and tectonic plates are observer independent, but money and property and government and marriage are all observer relative. It depends on our observations. It depends on our attitudes that these pieces of paper I carry around in my wallet are money. They're only money because we think they're money. Now notice the connection between these two. All observer relative phenomena contain an element of ontological subjectivity in their very existence, because it is only what it is. It's only money or private property or university or government or marriage or cocktail party or summer vacation because of the attitudes we take toward it, and those attitudes are ontologically subjective. So the observer relative phenomena are all created by ontological subjectivity. To put it crudely, they're created by human consciousness. However, notice an important fact that's going to come out to be important later, and that is that the consciousness that creates all observer relative phenomena is not itself observer relative. It's intrinsic. So though the stuff is money only because we think it's money, later on I'm going to argue this is true of computation and information and all sorts of other cognitive properties, that these are observer relative phenomena. But the phenomena that create the observer relative phenomena, the consciousness that creates the observer relative phenomena, is not itself observer relative. It's intrinsic or absolute. I'm speaking in rather shorthand terms here, but I think it's clear what I've said so far. Okay, now I'm going to try to lead into how all of this, these distinctions, bear on contemporary debates about information technology and cognition and all the rest of it. But before I do that, I have to review a debate that goes back 35 years, and I think a failure to understand the issues in that debate still continue to color some of the discussions today. All right, now I have to pause and apologize that I'm giving you this lecture in English. I admire people who can listen to lectures in languages other than the one they were born with. I could never do it myself. But I admire the patience. And so I want to make sure, je vais pas trop vite, j'ai pas l'habitude de donner des conférences en français. Hein. C'est fatigant à donner une conférence en français, et je vais essayer de vous donner ça en anglais, but if I'm going too fast or something like that, let me know. Okay, ça va comme ça, comme vitesse? I mean, just like this. Okay, I'll just continue at this sort of speed. Okay, now a long time ago, I guess before most of you were born, I got interested in something called artificial intelligence. And in the latter decades of the 20th century, there was great enthusiasm for AI. And it seemed to me they were making obviously false claims. These were based on the so-called Turing test from Alan Turing. And the most false claim was that they were inventing computers that literally had cognitive capacities. They could literally understand language and solve problems and, as they would say, process information. And it seemed to me they were making a rather serious mistake. The account of what I distinguish between strong AI, which said that the appropriately programmed digital computer literally has cognitive capacities in the same sense that you and I do, and what I call weak AI, that says that the appropriately programmed digital computer is a useful tool in studying cognition as it is a useful tool in studying anything. And I had no objection to weak AI, weak artificial intelligence, but I thought strong AI was making an obvious mistake and could be easily refuted. Incidentally, there was a rhetorical error on my part in using the metaphors of strong and weak. Because the MIT guys that I was dealing with, and MIT was just a shorthand for lots of other places, they were not going to accept any theory that described itself as weak. I mean, these were heavily testosterone-equipped researchers. In philosophy, our caution was such that it was much more courageous to adopt the weaker thesis. You were more likely to be right holding the weaker thesis, but you didn't want to tell these guys doing their programming that they should be holding a weak thesis. Anyway, so that was an unfortunate metaphor. However, strong AI, I think, can be refuted in a couple of sentences, and I did, though debate has gone on for 3.5 decades about these sentences. Basically, but here's the refutation. There was an equation that occurred in a very large number of textbooks that all had more or less the same title. They were called mind and computation, or computation and mind, or computers and the mind, or how the mind computes. You can find variations on these titles, but they're pretty much a limited number of options. And then the equation went, the mind is to the brain as the program is to the hardware. And essentially then, this gave us a wonderful research program in what the then new discipline of cognitive science, and the part of the beauty of it was you didn't have to know how the brain worked. What mattered for the mind was not the hardware. Any hardware will do if it's rich enough and stable enough to sustain the program. What we are studying as serious cognitive science is the program that's implemented in the brain. And a lot of the guys I knew in those days were very proud of the fact that they had no idea how the hardware of the computer worked. It's of no intellectual interest. When, you know, I get these guys in, my computer doesn't work, can you help me? That's for plumbers, you know. They weren't going to mess around with the hardware. What they were doing was serious science. They were designing the programs. So, and the project was, if you can design a program and you get it to pass the Turing test, and then you get your psychologist to see if that's the program that our brains are implementing. Psychologists in that era had exactly one experimental method. It was called reaction times. And they repeated that over and over to show that this is what the way that the brain is actually working, because the reaction times would mirror. The reaction times on the computer and the brain were supposed to show that the brain was operating on the same program. The idea then is you have created a mind. And I actually debated a guy on BBC television who said, we are creating minds. Nothing weak about that. Okay. Now, I thought admitted about a couple of minutes refutation. And here goes. You can time me. If that were right, then you could reproduce any cognitive capacity by simply programming the computer to carry out that capacity. But then a human being who didn't otherwise have that capacity could acquire it by carrying out that program. And I illustrated this with an argument that became fairly well known. I imagine that I don't know any Chinese, and in fact, I don't know any Chinese, and imagine that there is a program that enables me to answer questions in Chinese. And the designers of the program are so good at it, they give me a Chinese symbol. I don't know what it means. It's just a Chinese symbol. But I've got the program, and I look up in the program what I'm supposed to do, and then I give them back Chinese symbols. The symbols they give me are called questions. The ones I give back, the output, is called answers. And they get so good at designing the program, and I get so good at shuffling the symbols, that I pass the Turing test. My answers are indistinguishable from those of a native Chinese speaker. All the same, I don't understand a word of Chinese, and here's the bottom line. If I don't understand Chinese on the basis of implementing the computer program for story understanding, for understanding Chinese, then neither does any other digital computer on that basis, because no computer has anything I don't have. Okay, such a simple argument. And I was flying to Yale to give supposedly a week of lectures, and I was going to talk to the artificial intelligence lab at Yale, and I bought a book written by two guys at Yale to find out what they were doing. And I thought, well, there's this obvious objection, but they must have thought of that. And besides, I'm supposed to lecture for a whole week. Well, it turned out they hadn't thought of it. And a week was not nearly enough. And everybody was convinced I was wrong, but they didn't seem to agree on exactly why I was wrong. Well, I want to tell you why I think I'm right. And that is, the program is defined purely formally or syntactically. That's the power of the digital computer. That's what the Church-Turing hypothesis and Turing's conception of the Turing machine and Turing's theorem, that's what they all show, is the power of the computer derives from the fact that its operations are purely syntactical. Normally, it's a binary code, zeros and ones, but anything would do, Chinese symbols or anything else, provided you've got formally specifiable symbols and you can manipulate them. It's not a weakness of the computer that its operations are purely syntactical. But if the human mind has something more than a syntax, it has a semantic content. It has meanings attaching to the symbols, and that's why the syntactical simulation of human cognition will never reproduce the cognition, because all you've got is syntax going in and syntax coming out, just formal symbols. So the Chinese room argument, as it came to be called, rested on two rather simple principles. I think both of them logical truths. Syntax is not semantics. Just having the syntax is not enough for the semantics. And secondly, simulation is not duplication. You can simulate any cognitive capacity, but the simulation does not thereby become a duplication. And to see this, I like to put things in intuitive terms. Imagine that while I'm in this Chinese room, they also give me questions in English. And they give me the question, what's the longest river in the United States? I understand the question, I give an answer. It's the Mississippi River, though if you count the Missouri as part of the Mississippi, it's the Mississippi-Missouri. And then they give me another question in Chinese. I don't know what it means, it's just Chinese symbols. I look up what I'm supposed to do. The question is, what's the longest river in China? And I look up what I'm supposed to do, and I give back an answer that means the longest river is the Yangtze, but it's also got another name. Okay, I don't know what the question meant, I don't know what the answer meant, but I'm giving the right answers in both English and Chinese. What's the difference? It's my answers satisfy the Turing test in both cases. And the difference is that in Chinese, I'm just a computer, I'm just shuffling symbols. In English, I am a native speaker, so I understand the symbols as well as any other native speaker. Now, I had a lot of debates about this, and some absolutely breathtaking things were said, and I can't resist reminding you of a couple of them. One guy debated, said, look, you're there in this Chinese room, but suppose we give you the question, do you understand Chinese? And suppose you answer, yes. Of course, why do you ask me such idiotic questions? Doesn't that show I understand Chinese? Well, let's try it. I mean, here, I get this symbol. This will be in a dialect of Chinese that some of you won't recognize. I get a symbol that looks like that, and that means, do you understand Chinese? And I don't know what it means, but I give them a symbol that looks like this. It's in the same dialect of Chinese, and that symbol means, why do you guys ask me such dumb questions? Of course I understand Chinese. Okay, now I didn't want to spend much time on this because I think it's an obvious point that the syntax is not the same as the semantics and the simulation is not duplication. All the same, a lot of people feel that, well, okay, maybe you don't have literal understanding just in virtue of implementing the program, but you do nonetheless have a lot of cognitive capacities. The computer does literally process information. It does literally make inferences. It does literally win at chess and Jeopardy and have all sorts of other cognitive achievements. So what if it's not conscious? All the same, it does the crucial element in information processing. Indeed, that's what we design it to do, is information processing. Okay, now that's the next step in this debate, and I now want to attack that. And what I want to say is the importance of those distinctions I told you about a few moments ago between the observer relative and the observer independent and the different senses of objectivity and subjectivity, If we appreciate those, then you'll see that in fact, in this observer independent sense, in which I am thinking about arithmetic or thinking about the next chess move, the computer has none of that. The attributions of cognitive capacities to the computer are entirely observer relative. And the information that we attribute to the computer is like the information we attribute to a book. I happen to know the way to San Jose. There's a song about it. It's not a very good song. But I also can get this information from my GPS. The sense in which I have the information how to get to San Jose is intrinsic or observer independent. The sense in which the computer or the GPS has it is entirely observer relative. Now, why is that interesting to us? Well, for most purposes, it doesn't matter. I don't care how I get the information. And if you've got a computer program that can drive your car or fly an airplane, who cares if it's conscious? But if we're talking about what is psychologically relevant, what's the importance of all this for cognition, then it seems to me clear that the computer has no observer independent. It has no absolute cognitive capacities. To put it very crudely, the idea of Bostrom's that we're getting very smart computers and they're getting more intelligent, in the observer independent sense, the computer has zero intelligence. It has the capacity to simulate intelligence. It has observer relative attributions of intelligence that are vastly greater than was the case 30 years ago. But in the sense in which you or I have a certain level of intelligence, the computer has zero level of intelligence. And what goes for intelligence goes for cognition generally. Decision-making, problem-solving, playing chess, a memory, and even computation. And now I want to get to what I think will be more controversial, and that's this. It's very important that when Turing wrote his classic article, he didn't call it computation and intelligence. He called it computing machinery and intelligence. Why? In those days, a computer was a guy who computed. Computer was like a runner or a singer. It was somebody who engaged in computation. And what we've done is invent machines that can do these things better than we can. And so we make an observer relative attribution. So that the word computer now no longer means person who computes. It means an electronic circuit that you can use to perform computations. But this shouldn't disguise from us the fact that the computation in the computer is entirely observer relative. Now, this is a different argument from the Chinese room argument. I'm sorry it took me so long to see it. The Chinese room argument rests on the principle that the syntax by itself is not sufficient for semantics. But this argument goes deeper than says, furthermore, the physics is not sufficient for the syntax. The syntax is what you attribute to the physics. You don't discover it in the physics. To put it very crudely, there are no Turing machines in nature. In nature, there are physical processes, and some of them we can attribute computational properties to. And furthermore, we can invent machines to which we can attribute computational properties that are amazingly useful to us and have changed our life. Now, I want to remind you of my earlier distinction. Of course, it is epistemically objective that I am typing this on the Word program, and it's epistemically objective that my present computer has a bigger memory and a faster processor than earlier computers. That is the epistemic objectivity of the attributions of the phenomena should not disguise us from the fact that the phenomena are nonetheless observer relative. Computation does not exist in nature, it is observer relative, but the observer relative attributions can be epistemically objective. It's perfectly objective to say that I wrote this on the word processing program, but the word processing program does not name a fact of physics. It names an observer relative fact about the sort of attributions that we make. And I think it's important to understand this, that just about all of the cognitive attributions that we make to both people and machines, that those cognitive attributions are systematically ambiguous between an observer independent sense and an observer relative sense. I'm thinking of intelligence, memory, decision making, game playing, information processing, and the notion of computation itself is systematically ambiguous between an observer independent sense and an observer relative sense. So if I say I'm going to perform a simple computation, I'm going to add 1 plus 1 to get 2. That computation was intrinsic. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. I was actually carrying out that computation. But the marks on the blackboard don't do that intrinsically. The marks on the blackboard only represent that computation relative to our assignment to those marks of a certain semantics, of a certain computational interpretation. And I think a great deal of the confusion in the present debates stems from the failure to see these distinctions that I'm trying to make. So let me mention the two authors. I'm sorry neither of them is here, because I was looking forward to having a chance for them to reply, because I already had imagined my replies to their replies. I'm sorry neither of them is here. Bostrom's worry is smart computers are going to overthrow us all, or they might. He says this may be the greatest problem that humanity has ever faced. I guess these guys know how to sell books better than I do. I could never write a sentence like that. But in any case, I want to say the intelligence in the smart computer is exactly zero. There's no intelligence whatever. It's all observer relative. It doesn't mean that it's epistemically subjective, but its ontology is observer relative. So I think it's not a real worry. I mean, suppose somebody said, well, shoes are smarter than they used to be. And who knows, the shoes might get tired of being walked on and they'll come out of the closet and walk all over us. It's not a real worry. And that's exactly the same situation I feel about computers, that somehow the computer's gonna rise up and take over. It's not even interesting science fiction. Now, Florides, that's Bostrom's hypothesis, that we face an apocalypse. And the apocalypse may be the greatest challenge humanity has ever faced, and that is they're going to take over and destroy us all because they're so much smarter than we are. Florides is much more optimistic. We live in a wonderful new era, the era of information. And he tells us everything is information. You want to see information? Look around you. Everything is information. And what are we? We are inforgs. The answer to that is the information that you're talking about is entirely observer relative. There's a fairly small amount of information in my brain, and that's real. That's intrinsic. But the other stuff is all observer relative. It's in computers and libraries and GPS systems and so on. So the idea that somehow everything is information trivializes the notion, because it neglects the fact that you don't discover information, you attribute it. Let me put it in computational terms. If you want to see a very simple computer, I'll compute a function for you. This computer, I let it fall from there to there, it just computed the function s equals 1/2 gt squared. But if that's a computer, then so is everything. And in the old Chinese room days, there would often come a point in the debate where I would take an object like this, slam it on the table, and say, that is a digital computer. It just has a very boring program. The program says, stay there. And the funny thing is, nobody ever challenged me, because they'd all read the same. I didn't read the textbooks, but they told me about what the textbook said. And the textbook said, anything to which you can make a computational attribution is a computer. This has a one-step program. Stay there. And it's a digital computer as much as any other digital computer. But if this is a digital computer and that's computation, when I drop it, then everything's a digital computer and everything's computation. And that's not distressing to us, because it's all observer relative. Now remember, observer relativity implies ontological subjectivity, but it does not imply that you cannot make epistemically objective claims. It's perfectly legitimate that I pay more for my present computer than I did for earlier, weaker computers, because it is more powerful. And the power there is the power of my ability to make attributions to it, which are epistemically objective. It really does help me to figure out such and such issues in a way that earlier technologies did not. Okay, I'm probably running out of time, so let me wind this up by going through some standard questions that people often ask in these debates. The first question is this. Could a machine think? Now, I want you to notice the obsolescence of all these old categories. Look, we're all machines. Of course a machine could think, because we can all think and we're all machines. If a machine is a physical system capable of performing certain functions, then every normal human being is a machine, and human beings can think. The distinction between man and machine, as it used to be called, I think is obsolete, because of course we are machines and we can think. So that's not the interesting question. So let's ask the next question. How about a man-made machine? Could that think? How about something thinking that was not natural or biological, but was made by human beings? And I think that question we ought to hear like the question, can you make an artificial heart that pumps blood? And the answer is yes, it's an engineering problem. So I don't see any philosophical obstacle to building thinking machines. The difficulty is, unlike the heart, we don't know how the brain does it. We know that the brain does it by specific neurobiological processes, but we don't know exactly what those processes are, and until we do know, we're unlikely to be able to duplicate it in nature. So a man-made machine could think if it could duplicate and not just simulate, but actually duplicate the causal powers of the brain to create consciousness and thought processes. Okay, so let's try a third question. Well, the third question is, yes, but how about a machine not made out of the kind of flesh and blood that we're made of, not made out of human tissue, made out of some other kinds of chemical substances? And the answer to that is we don't know. It seems to me no obstacle in principle. When we build an artificial heart, we don't feel we have to build it out of muscle tissue. We just want something that'll do the same job. It might turn out that there's some biochemistry of the brain that's essential for cognition, but if that's so, we don't know it. We don't know that that's the case. So our question is not, can a machine think? Of course it can, yes. Could a man-made machine think? Why not? I mean, if it can pump blood, it ought to be able, in principle, we ought to be able to do with what brains do with some other type of machinery. Okay, but could it actually do it in a different type of machinery than the nucleoproteins that we use? And there, that seems to me an open question. We don't know the answer to that. But now we get to the more crucial question, is computation enough? Is computation enough for thinking? And we know that the answer is no. Computation is standardly defined. Is purely syntactical, and the syntax is not enough for actual human cognition. And then our final question is, but all the same, if computation is not enough for cognition, it might be an essential component of cognition, and it might be the case that intelligence, computation, and cognition are all real features of these artificial machines that we're currently making, even if they don't have a semantics. And that's one thing I'm trying to add now that was not in my original Chinese room argument, and that is that all of those properties are systematically ambiguous between an observer independent or absolute sense, in which they don't depend on anybody's interpretation, and an observer relative sense, in which they're entirely relative to our interpretation. So I think there, just to conclude this, there are a series of systematic confusions that muddy the waters here. And the newspapers and the television don't help us, because they are constantly, the temptation to hype is overwhelming. And they have to claim that, well, this wonderful thing happened. When Deep Blue finally beat Kasparov, I was living in Paris and I got a call from New York. Isn't this a blow to human dignity? And I said, look, my pocket calculator can outperform any mathematician that ever lived. Is that a blow to human dignity? The idea is ridiculous. I mean, why is chess interesting to us? You see, from a games theoretical point of view, chess is trivial. You have perfect information. both about what the position is, what the positions are, and what the possible moves are, and what the possible counter moves to the moves are. So games, theoretically, chess is a trivial game. But it's interesting to us because of the exponential factor. Once you figure out the move, the possible counter moves, the counter moves to that move, then it's astronomical, and no human being could ever do it. Deep Blue won. See, Deep Blue is a very little psychological interest because it won by calculating to the 12th place. The tree went to 12 different places, far more than any human being could conceivably do. And the only reason they could do it is that they got the hardware to process 250 million chess moves in 1 second. In every second, Deep Blue could process 250 million chess positions. So it's of no psychological interest. But chess is interesting to us because of, in effect, because of our limitations. We can't do any more than a tiny number of the possible exponential possibilities. So we continue to find it interesting. But the systematic mistakes that people make have to do, I think, with a failure to recognize, with a failure to acknowledge and use certain fundamental distinctions, such as the distinction between the intrinsic and the observer relative, and the distinction between different kinds of objectivity and subjectivity. Thank you.